Well, good morning again, everyone, and appreciate you all being out here today on God's Sabbath day to take a rest from all this weekly toil that we go through. And today I want to spend a little bit of time, actually it's on the heels of what Mr. Barnett was talking about in some ways, because we're going to be talking about the fullness of time in relation to what Paul was speaking about in Galatians chapter 4. I want to today, and this is a two-part sermon series, and they can stand by themselves, but today I want to talk about the first part here, the fullness of times of what the Roman Empire was like when Jesus came into existence. What was it like? And we'll look at some comparisons and contrast some of the things that were going on in the Roman Empire and particularly in the life of Augustus Caesar and the life of Jesus Christ when he came on the scene here, and see how these things kind of match up. So I think to get a good understanding of what is happening at this time, I'm going to have to spend some time going through some of the past. This is a historical sermon, so I hope that you can stay awake for it and follow what I'm trying to get to here. But I'd like you to turn to Galatians chapter 4. I don't have this up on the screen, and I want to read this first scripture in Galatians chapter 4 in verse 3 and 4. To set the springboard here for my message this morning, Galatians chapter 4. Galatians chapter 4 and verse 3. Even so, we, when we were children, were in bondage under the elements of the world. But when the fullness of time was come, God sent forth his Son, made of a woman, made under the law. So when the fullness of time was come, the Father had determined, you know, what was to occur in order to bring forth his Son into this world to become the Savior for all of mankind, by taking on our sins that we might present ourselves to God as a holy vessel. The Gospel of Luke and the Gospel of Matthew contain the two infancy narratives in the Bible. They contain information that surround the birth of Jesus Christ. Now, there's a little bit of a difference between those two infancy narratives, and I like to treat them separately and look at them from two different perspectives. Today, we want to look at the account contained in Luke chapter 2 for this sermon. So go ahead and turn to Luke chapter 2, and I want to read through a few scriptures here in Luke that will lead us here into some of the information that I want to give you today. Luke chapter 2, and look at verse 1. And it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. And this taxing was first made when Cyrenius was governor of Syria. And all went to be taxed, every one into his own city. And Joseph also went up from Galilee, out of the city of Nazareth, into Judea, unto the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be taxed with Mary, his espoused wife, being great with child. And so it was that while they were there, the days were accomplished that she should be delivered. And she brought forth her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling clothes, laid him in a manger because there was no room for them in the inn. A lot of stuff here. And we don't have time to spend going over all the different images that come up in our heads because we've been brainwashed to believe certain ways. But Luke mentions the name of someone very important in the world that he is juxtaposing with Jesus. Notice the text reads, Caesar Augustus. Now, Luke was written probably around 60 AD, which means his audience would have lived under the fifth Roman emperor, and about 45 or so years after the death of Caesar Augustus. So if we want to put that into a real-world equivalency for us, you know, it would be equivalent to the end of World War II and about 1990. That would be about the same time frame. Or from today to 1974, back in the mid-70s. This isn't too far removed, really. With Augustus being the first emperor of the Roman Empire, it's likely that, you know, they would have been very familiar with him, who he was, and what was going on at the time. It would be similar to me saying to you, in the days of Jimmy Carter, I don't really have to say much more for you to understand what was going on in the days of Jimmy Carter. You have a very good feeling of what was happening in the world at that time. Or I could say in the days of Ronald Reagan. And this image comes to your mind of what was happening in the world you would be familiar with. Or in the days of Abraham Lincoln. Or in the days of Barack Obama. All of these things that I say, it brings an image to your mind. You know what was happening in the world at that time. You know who these people were. You know what they were like. You don't really need to say much else. You don't need a PhD to understand these things that transpired at the time of the presidents, because you were there, or you were very familiar with those events that occurred because they were very close to you. If I said, in the days of the American Revolution, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And this is what Luke is trying to portray to us now. And you say, okay, I know the time frame we're talking about, and the things that surrounded that time. You would totally understand the context. And so that's precisely what Luke was doing when he says, in the days of Caesar Augustus. We sort of look at this and just sort of pass it over. But he's trying to tell us something here. They would understand what was going on. We need to understand what was going on. So what I want to do today is help you understand what the first century world understood when they heard the words in the days of Caesar Augustus. Because until we understand him and what he was up to and why he was on the throne as the first emperor of Rome, we won't fully understand the significance of the birth of Jesus Christ in this particular epoch in history, why he came about at this time. So let's look at the backstory. So the backstory starts with Rome, the Roman Empire. This right here, you can see all in the green here, is a slide of the Roman Empire around the time of Caesar Augustus. Now, Caesar Augustus ruled from from 27 BC through 14 AD, and he was the emperor, as we said, when Jesus Christ was born. Now, how did Rome get control of all of this territory? That's a massive amount of territory. How did they do it? And the answer is they did it through military conquest. Military conquest. Rome captured their territories through battles, and they ruled from England all the way down to about the Iran area, about to Persia. And so it all started in 753, as the story goes. That's when Rome was founded, according to mythology. But the Roman Republic was founded around 509 BC. But it wasn't until about 146 BC at a place called Carthage that Rome began to send signals to the rest of the world that they meant business. If I can get that thing, there it is. Here's Carthage. You can see Carthage there on the tip of Africa across from Sicily. So they had conquered Carthage, which was a very powerful nation at this time, and it was a very wealthy nation due to its proximity here in the Mediterranean Sea. They had a lot of trade going on, and that made them very wealthy. The same year, the Romans took out Corinth, which was the main city of Greece at the time. And so now all of a sudden, the Mediterranean world is really getting concerned because they took out Carthage, and then they took out Corinth. And these are major trade routes. Goes right through that Mediterranean Sea area. And then 13 years later, they took out all of Asia Minor and what is today called Turkey. In 63 BC, they take Israel, they take Syria, Jordan, they take Lebanon. And in 30 BC, they took Egypt. And at this point, they were the uncontested rulers of the world. And they took all of this land through military might. They took it through war. There are some early poets and historians of the Roman Empire that give us some insight on how they conducted their business at that time. The principal poet at the time of Caesar Augustus was Virgil. And I think many of you are familiar with the poet Virgil. I want you to notice what he says about how Rome is to rule the world. You, O Roman, remember to rule the nations with might. This will be your genius, to impose the way of peace, to spare the conquered, and crush the proud. This is how you do it. Accordingly, the way you bring peace in the world is through the sword. And this is one of the ways that they communicated their message to the world. They also communicated their message in another way. If you wanted to communicate messages to the world, you didn't send out emails. There's no texting. There's no internet. There's no Twitter. You couldn't send out Twitters or tweets, I should say. If you want to communicate a message, one of the ways that it was done was through coinage, because they circulated throughout the empire. This is one of the coins during the reign of Caesar Augustus. Actually, I bought a coin in Israel of Caesar Augustus, and I forgot to bring it. I was going to bring it so you could see it. It's a little bit different because there was different coins that were struck. But this particular coin I wanted to put up because it is a significant importance. On the front side is the Roman goddess Pax, which is the Roman goddess of peace. And then on the other side, you'll see Caesar there, the divine Caesar. In fact, you see D-I-V-I and this on the right side, and then Caesar on the left side there. Divine Caesar. And this is Caesar Augustus, who's dressed up in the military garb there, military outfit. And you can see he has his spear in hand. So really, the symbolism can't be more clear, I think. The way that you get peace and you hold it in the Roman Empire is you crush nations, you crush peoples. And it's been said that Carthage was the first case of genocide the world had ever seen. And this is the style of rule and conquest they followed to gain all the territories of the earth that they gained. Now, Tacitus was a Roman senator and a Roman historian of the Roman Empire. And though he came shortly after the writing of Luke, this is what he recorded about the major Roman general Germanicus during the reign of Caesar Augustus. Germanicus was considered one of the greatest generals of the Roman Empire and was known for coming into areas and absolutely decimating the areas. This is what the historian Tacitus wrote about Germanicus. For 50 miles around, he, that is Germanicus, wasted the country with sword and flame. Neither age nor sex inspired pity. Places sacred and profane were razed indifferently to the ground. Only the destruction of the race would end the war. A Greek historian by the name of Polybius, who was an eyewitness to the sacking of Carthage, said this: "It seems to me they do this for the sake of terror." That's Polybius. You see, the Romans employed an ancient equivalent of shock and awe and terrorized people into the submission of their peace. Beginning with Caesar Augustus, Roman emperors were considered gods. Before that, that wasn't the case. But with Caesar Augustus, they were considered gods. And if your community didn't recognize them as such, then the army would come in and they would loot and they would rape and then they would, pillage and they would burn the community down. And those that were left that were fighting, usually the leaders, those were the people that the Romans would take and they would crucify. Now, the Romans didn't invent crucifixion. That was likely the Persians who did that. But the Romans perfected it. They said that they could keep someone alive on the cross for 3 days before dying. This is how they terrorized the people. Quintilian was a Roman educator, and he wrote this about the crucifixion. "Whenever we crucify the guilty, the most crowded roads are chosen, where the most people can see and be moved by this fear. For penalties relate not so much to retribution as to their exemplary effect." So they were to show to everyone else, you don't do this because this is what's going to happen. Josephus wrote this: "In 4 BC, after destroying villages and slaughtering their residents, Verus had his soldiers round up the leaders of the insurrection and crucified about 2,000. Now, we're not talking about 10 or 20 people. We're talking about a massive amount of people, a big number of people, thousands of people. They had so many people they were crucifying, they were running out of trees. They didn't have enough trees to crucify all those people. They wanted to make a statement so that everyone understood, Rome is your ruler. Caesar is your god. Tacitus wrote this. He said, "You have sought in vain to escape the Romans' oppression by obedience and submissiveness. They are the plunderers of the world. If the enemy is rich, they are rapacious. If poor, they lust for dominion. Not east, not west has sated them. They rob, butcher, plunder, and call it empire. And where they make a desolation, they call it peace. I think it is, yeah. Call it peace. Tacitus. And this is how the Romans worked. This is how they conquered all the lands that they conquered. And when you look at this Roman Empire, this is how they got all of that green area. A massive, massive area that the world, the biggest area the world had ever seen, the biggest empire the world had ever seen up to that point. This is the empire that was ruling the world. This is the world that Jesus was born into, the world that saw this massive empire rise. Now, the Roman Empire in various forms would last for, you know, if you put the whole time span out, maybe 1600 years or so. And no one had seen anything like it at the time. And when Jesus was born, Augustus was the emperor of the empire. But how did we get there? How did we get to Caesar being the emperor of this empire? Rome had up to that point been a republic. I mean, you go back and you look at the past. You can talk about the Republic of the Plato's. I'm going back even further. But this wasn't. You didn't have an empire of this scope, right? So you had a Senate, you know, that were able to rule, and you had generals who were answering to the Senate. But now we have this emperor on the throne. So how did it begin? Well, to see how Rome went from republic to empire, we need to begin with Julius Caesar, the inventor of the Caesar salad. Just kidding. I think I thought that when I was a kid. He did not invent the Caesar salad, as far as I know. Here is Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar was never an emperor, but his name was used for the emperor. But it begins right here. He was a Roman general who had been in a civil war with another Roman general by the name of Pompey. And Pompey was the one who came into Israel and took it for the Romans in about 63 B.C. and claimed Israel for Rome. This is when they were taken over. But these two generals were going at it. And Pompey was eventually assassinated in Egypt. And Julius Caesar is now the one who has the military power in Rome. And he is part of the Senate, partially because of his family standing and his conquests. But the amount of power that he had made the Senate very concerned about him and what he was going to do. So, and they were so concerned, in fact, that the Senate, this is a spoiler alert, if you ever go to read, you know, Julius Caesar by Shakespeare. Spoiler alert! he was killed. He was killed in unison by the whole Senate. Now, there were mainly two people behind the plot. There was Brutus and there was Cassius, and Brutus was the protege of Julius Caesar. And they killed him on the Ides of March. Remember the play, the Ides of March, March 15th. Now, from 44 B.C., there are several events that transpire to the making of Caesar Augustus. In 44 B.C., Julius Caesar is assassinated. And in his will, he leaves his adopted son, Octavius. Caesar Augustus was known as Octavian before he took this new name. So you know the transfer here. So he gave his adopted son, Octavian, all of his worldly belongings, including all of his offices. So all of his titles, his offices, those all transferred to him as well. Octavian was the great nephew of Julius Caesar. Octavian will become known, as I said, as Caesar Augustus eventually. And then in 43 BC, a second triumvirate was formed. Octavian, and then everyone knows Mark Antony and Cleopatra. They've heard of Mark Antony and Cleopatra. So Mark Antony was the second of that triumvirate. And then you had Lepidus. People don't know much about him. But the power of Rome is effectively in the hand of these three generals now, sort of split. And the Senate is still there, but it's concerned. It's concerned about the power that's waning in their hands. So in 42 BC, Julius Caesar is officially deified by the Senate by decree. And then after the death of Julius Caesar, there was some celestial event that occurred, which is actually why he was deified. And let me see, do I have that? Actually, I will show you that here in just a second. But there was a comet that came through at this time. And at the time, it was the brightest comet. They didn't know it was a comet at the time. It was the brightest comet that anyone had ever seen. And actually, I think it was Octavian who said, that is Julius Caesar with the gods. He's a god. He's divine. And so I think it was 2 years later that the Senate finally said, yes, we agree. And that's when they put this decree upon him, and they deified him officially. And so this comet that came through, they called it Caesar's Comet. Now, today we don't call it Caesar's Comet. We call it Halley's Comet. That was the comet that came through. But Octavian himself, he had declared him, he declared the spirit of Julius Caesar ascending to the right hand of the Most High God in heaven, which was Jupiter to them, because Caesar was divine. And so when the Roman Senate finally agreed, then this happened. If Julius Caesar was God and Octavian was the son of Caesar, then what does that make Octavian? It makes him the son of God. It makes him the son of God. And so he claimed the title, the son of God. And he played on this in a big way. In 19 BC, a Roman coin was struck with Caesar Augustus on the head. And you can see that here. And on the other side of the image of the coin was the image of the comet that would promote the image that his father was a god and that he was now known as the son of a god. Also in 42 BC, Octavian and Antony defeat Brutus and Cassius at Philippi. Now, they actually commit suicide, killing themselves on the battlefield, but this eventually avenges the death of Julius Caesar, his adopted father. And then in 36 BC, Lepidus was removed from power by Octavian in a political move. And so now that he's got those two guys out of the way, who's left? Octavian. He's the only one left. That leaves Octavian. Mark Antony had committed suicide along with his cohort, Elizabeth Taylor. Cleopatra. She played a good Cleopatra, by the way. But Mark Antony and Cleopatra committed suicide, so Octavian was the only one left. That was at the Battle of Actium that they were defeated. So after this defeat, Octavian is left with the power. And so when he's left with the power, he rules the world. He takes the world at this time. Now, look here. We have, so if I get this slide right, we have Italy here. You can see Italy on the right slide in the center there. And we have Asia Minor to the right. So I kind of blew this up. If you look to the left picture on this slide, you can see Asia Minor there, which is next to Greece. But basically everything to the east of Asia Minor is run through Asia Minor. So all the decisions, in other words, come to Asia Minor, which actually I think was called Asia at the time. It's kind of confusing to me. But all the elders sat in Asia or Asia Minor. So all the information, all the flow, all the decisions, all of these things came out of Asia Minor or Asia, where all these seven churches of Revelation actually were. This is a very popular area. The elders of the Roman Empire were right there. This is probably a whole different sermon on that. But the elders of Asia had sided with Mark Antony, actually, during this battle time when they were battling for the empire. But now that Mark Antony's gone, now they're scrambling. Well, wait a second, we picked the wrong side. We chose the wrong person. And so what they did was they went to Octavian and they told him, we picked the wrong person. And it wasn't, there's actually evidence in the literature, from what I understand, that it wasn't just sucking up to Octavian to make sure they didn't get killed. They actually believed that Octavian was the chosen one, that he was the one that was to bring peace to the empire, that it was his duty, that it was his divine right to be called the Son of God, and that he would bring prosperity to this fractured world. And they were so serious that they said to Octavian, you know, you're very smart, you're very strategic, and in fact, you are divine yourself, and we want to erect, for the very first time in history, a temple for emperor worship to you, Octavian. And we want to put it in Pergamum, the capital of Asia. Now, Octavian was a very shrewd man, very smart man, and he recognized that back in Rome, that the Senate was very concerned that they were losing power. They were losing power to Octavian, and they were wondering what was going to happen through their cherished republic. So Octavian says to the elders, he says this in a very diplomatic way. He says, listen, I'll give you the right to go ahead and erect a temple to me in Pergamum as long as you erect a temple to my father, Julius Caesar, and to Roma, which was the personification of the Roman Empire, and joint temples at Ephesus and Nicaea. So he says, as long as you do that, you can erect a temple for me in Pergamum. And so in 29 BC, the first temple of emperor worship, where people can come from around the world and worship Octavian, the son of God, was erected. 2 years later, in 27 BC, Octavian goes to the Senate because they're getting more concerned than ever now about what was happening. And he said to the Senate, listen, I understand your concerns. I understand you're worried about the Republic. I understand you're worried about the glory of Rome. And he said, I'm willing to give back my power to the Senate so that you don't have to worry about that, because the direction of the Roman Empire, the Roman Republic right now, is going in a very good direction, because wars are ceasing, peace is coming, we're moving in the right direction, it's a good direction, and this is where we want to continue. And the Senate says to Octavian, he says, you're right. They said, you're right, we're moving in a good direction. And the civil wars have mostly come to an end. And they said to him, since you're willing to give up most of your power, we're not going to take it from you. In fact, we're going to give you more. And so rather than taking the power back, they gave him all power, and the Republic now becomes an empire for the first time in history. And they convey upon Octavian the title Augustus, which means great or venerable one, which carries religious overtones to it. And he takes the name of his father and is now called Caesar Augustus, the first emperor of the Roman world. At this point, people begin talking about what this moment means in history and what they believe to be true about Caesar Augustus, about who he is, about why he was born, about why he was there. And this is what they were saying about Caesar Augustus. This is what Horace, the Roman poet, wrote. Thine age, O Caesar, has brought back fertile crops to the fields, has wiped away our sins and revived the ancient virtues. And the fame and majesty of our empire were spread from the sun's bed in the west to the east. As long as Caesar is the guardian of the state, neither civil dissension nor violence shall banish peace. And of course, we know the peace came through this rough style of crush and conquer. Virgil said this, lo, under his auspices, my son, that's Octavian or Caesar Augustus, that glorious Rome shall bound her empire by earth and her pride by heaven. This is he whom thou so oft heard promised in thee, Augustus Caesar, son of a god, who again set up the golden age. This is the one who brought about all things, they said, was Augustus Caesar. Here is an inscription found in southwest Turkey. It's a place called Priene. And this is, they think, at least 3 to 4 years before the birth of Christ. It's very, very close. 3 to 4 years before the birth of Christ. This is on the inscription. Since Providence, which has ordered all things and is deeply interested in our life, has set in most perfect order by giving us Augustus, whom she filled with virtue that he might benefit mankind, sending him as a savior both for us and for our descendants, that he might end war and arrange all things. And since he, Caesar, by his appearance excelled even our anticipations, surpassing all previous benefactors, and not even leaving to posterity any hope of surpassing what he has done. And since the birthday of the god Augustus was the beginning of the gospel, the good news for the world. Notice this little section there in the pre-NA calendar. I'm going to pull out there just at the end. Get over there. This is the pre-NA inscription. I think this is the British Museum, I believe. The beginning of the gospel of Caesar Augustus. About 9 BC is the date on this. Now, the Greek word for gospel is euangelion, which is where we get the word evangelism, we get the word for evangelist from. They said that this is the good news of Caesar Augustus. By the way, how does Mark begin his biography on the life of Jesus? Can you turn to Mark chapter 1, please? I'd like you to turn to Mark chapter 1. And I want you to look and see what Mark writes at the very beginning of his book in Mark chapter 1 and verse 1. Mark chapter 1. Everybody there? Mark chapter 1 and verse 1. Look what it says. It says the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. It's practically identical. What are the writers doing here? What's happening? Well, I think what's happening is they're helping us to see, if Mark was doing anything, he's helping us to see that when Jesus comes onto the scene, that we have a clash of the gods. We have a clash of cultures. We have Caesar, the Son of God, and we have Jesus, the Son of God. Now, if you wanted to break down Caesar Augustus in a few talking points, you say, well, what is Caesar Augustus all about? What is his message? What is he bringing? What is he here for? Let me give you some talking points here about Caesar Augustus. And what his kingdom was about. Caesar Augustus, he was, they said, the divine Son of God. Who brings a gospel of good news. He brings this gospel of good news. I can get this thing going. Of peace. And that's the Pax Romana. That they brought that peace. He brought this peace. And he brings salvation for humanity. And how does he do this? He does this through the forgiveness of sins. This is the talking point for Caesar Augustus. Does this disturb anybody when you see this? Do you see the descriptions are the same here? I'm sure you do. When you look at this, you have to be saying to yourself, what's going on here? What's happening? This is the exact language we use for Jesus Christ. And it was used before Jesus Christ was born. Now, there's an important point here in that the description is the same, which makes it that there is a choice between the two. In other words, one is a fraud and one is authentic. One is real and one is fake. And you can't have both of them. You know, when we were in Israel, we were at the temple of Artemis in, help me out, where were we? The place where we weren't, Jerash. So it's supposed to be the best well-preserved temple of Artemis in the ancient world, in the world. And so we walk up to this temple, to these steps, and as we were leaving, there's always some people that are selling coins there or something. And so there was a gentleman there. We were getting ready to go, and he's like, he had these two coins in here, and I don't remember who they were. Maybe one was Caesar Augustus. Somebody was somebody else. I don't remember. Very worn coins, and I think he was trying to sell them to me for like $45, something like that for the two. He's going to give me a great deal. So I looked at them. I thought, well, they look pretty worn. I can kind of see the inscription on there. Man, they look really good. I wasn't sure, but I kind of said, okay, well, I'll just take a chance. So I bought them. And so I never really knew. So we went to an antiquities dealer one night with Randall Price and the whole group. Well, there's just a few of us that went there. And there was two coins that I saw. One was of Caesar Augustus, and one was of Constantine that I went ahead and purchased. And when I looked at these two coins, and I compared them to the two coins that I bought at the Temple of Artemis, there was quite a bit of difference. And so it was actually last night I was looking at these thinking, how do you tell between a fake coin and what's not fake? One's real and one's fake. And so I took a picture of this, and I was reading some more stuff about it. And as I was taking my picture and I zoomed in on it, I could see some rust on the side of the coins that I bought at the Temple of Artemis. And a lot of looks like a lot of flaking that was coming off on the surface that I couldn't see visually, you know, just looking at it. But as I inspected it closer, I could see the difference. And so as of last night, I figured, well, I bought two fake coins. So I have two real coins. I think I do. At least they look good. And I have two, so I bought from an antiquities dealer, and I have two fake coins. And on the surface, when I look at them, I really can't tell the difference. But it's when you inspect closer and you know what you're looking for, then you find the difference in them. And that's kind of like what we see here. We have these two competitors on the scene. And when the fullness of time was come, God sent forth his Son. He sent forth his Son. This is the same language that is spoken about of Caesar Augustus. And so we have two opposing rulers, but they function completely differently. So you can see why Paul wrote, in the fullness of times. You can see the pieces coming together here. Now, let's go back to the Old Testament for a moment. Because there was a series of events that occurred under the hand of God that are setting the stage for the coming of the Messiah. Now, in 586, you'll remember that the southern kingdom of Judah and Benjamin were taken to captivity by the head of the gold in Daniel chapter 2 of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, there were three different deportations of Judah. We call the main deportation the fall of the temple in 586. So the Jews were torn from the land in which they had disobeyed God. But they had to get back to the land because there was a prophecy that had to be fulfilled, that the Messiah was to be born in Bethlehem. And the Jews knew it, and of course God was not slack on his promises, so he set up another world ruling power to take over the Babylonians, and that was the Persians. They took over Persians took over the Babylonians. This was the silver belt or chest, I should say, of Daniel chapter 2, a great image. And under the Persian rule, Cyrus the Great was moved by God to send all the exiles home. Now, this happened in 539 BC. In fact, he did this to all of the captives, not just to the Jews, but to all the captives of the kingdom. And he didn't just send them home. He gave them money to build a new temple, to rebuild the temple. And he returned all the gold and the silver cups that Nebuchadnezzar had taken, all those that were in service to the temple. He returned all those as well. Now, this had to be something that was just amazing to behold if you were a Jew in those days, to see what God was doing through through Cyrus, to be able to send them back to the land and to be able to rebuild the temple that he was paying for. And everything that they had lost, they were returned to them. Then in 336 BC, Alexander the Great takes the throne from his father Philip II, and he then conquers the known world in 13 years. In 13 years, he conquers the known world. But the world is too large to rule by itself the way it is. So he said, the only way that I can do this, he says, we really need to have a common language. That way I can communicate my message throughout the whole world. So he made it so that they had a unifying language that would pull the world together, that could make trade easier, that could make transactions easier. And he mandated that Greek was to be spoken throughout all the world. And so this is what happened. Alexander said, everyone's going to learn Greek. And this is going to be the unifying language that was going to be so important at the time when the gospel message went out. So when Jesus Christ came onto the scene, how convenient it was that the New Testament was written in Greek, the same language that the entire world knew. That was the way that was going to go forward. And then, when Rome comes onto the scene, the empire brought about a peace. Now, it was a peace through war, but it was a peace in some respects. It was a peace that came at the expense of brutality and to those under the boot of the Romans. But the world, in reality, was mostly stable at that point. It was a stability that the world had not seen up to that point in history, or at least for a very long time. And the Romans made a great contribution that helped further the gospel message on top of the common Greek language. So not only did you have, under the beast power, the return of the Jews to the land of Israel, then you had a common language that unified everyone, and then the Romans came and they said, we need to be able to get to the far reaches of this Roman Empire to be able to put down squabbles, to be able to transport the military might to keep the peace in this kingdom, in this empire. And the way they said they had to do it was they had to build roads. They had to build roads all over the empire. They built so many roads that it equals the interstate system in the U.S. today. Over 50,000 miles, some suggest up to 80,000 miles of well-quality, good roads that many are actually lasting on today. This is the way that they were able to get around the empire so quickly. Here's a picture of a couple of Roman roads that are 2,000 years old. And you can see they still function today. They didn't have to be resurfaced. They didn't have to grind them down. They didn't have to be, you know, asphalted over again. Those roads are still there. Now, of course, they're not traveled like our roads are. But the point is that they spent a lot of time and effort, certainly through God's hands, to make these roads all over the place. The same roads that Jesus was able to walk, that Paul was able to walk on, to be able to be transported throughout all of Asia, to preach the gospel, to get the message out to the world. Now, don't forget the idea that Augustus was considered a God-man. He was considered both man and God. Now, the pharaohs had the idea as well, but it was a localized idea. It didn't spread throughout the empire. It was localized right there. But this idea of Augustus being man and God was actually an idea that spread throughout the whole empire. Now, could that have helped people understand Jesus as man and God? Possibly. I don't know, but it could have been that concept that was spread. But Jesus was not man become God, as Octavius was, supposedly. He was God condescending to come down to this earth to become man and offer up his life so that you could become God. It's quite a difference in the two. Now, another thing I want to bring out here is that if you were to pick one location on the earth to birth a message in the ancient world, if you could pick the most highly trafficked area, where would you pick? Israel. Israel is absolutely the most highly trafficked area in the world because it was a sea bridge from the Mediterranean Sea over to the Middle Eastern countries. You could get from there, cross the land, so right, you could have seaports. And then also it was a land bridge. It was a land bridge so that you could transfer, go from three different continents, Asia to Africa, Asia to Europe, Europe to Africa, all of these. There was a massive trade route that went all through this area. And so if you wanted to rule the world, in many respects, you wanted to rule Israel. And if you wanted to birth a message, this was a great place to birth a message to transfer that information up and down, because even the Galilee was right next to one of the superhighways of the ancient world of trade. And so that message got out even as people walked through the Galilee area or came through Galilee. In the fullness of times, God acted at the right time to bring about his purpose. So with that understanding, I want you to go to Luke chapter 2. Luke chapter 2, and let's look at verse 1. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. This was the first registration when Quirinius was governor of Syria. And all went to be registered, each to his own town. And Joseph also went up from Galilee, from the town of Nazareth to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and the lineage of David, to be registered with Mary, his betrothed, who was with child. And while they were there, the time came for her to give birth. Now, when we hear census, we think that they would just travel so that they could sign their name to a registry and be counted in a number for the Roman Empire. But there was much more to a census than that. You know, today, there will be a census taken up in the U.S. this year. I think 2020, we have a census coming up. And this census will have long-lasting implications for years to come. Depending on how many people live in a certain district or a certain state, will determine how many electoral college votes they get. It determines how redistricting all goes about. It determines how much federal grant money certain areas will get in this nation. How much money is appropriated for state to states to build roads, for instance, to build federal highways, for planning services, for Medicaid, for Medicare, to congressional seating. Its tentacles are vast. They're deep. They go everywhere into this social structure. And so the Roman census really was no less important. It was very important because to continue the Roman Empire, money was needed for the military to keep its peace, right, and to continue conquering. And that money doesn't come out of thin air. That money comes from the backs of hardworking people, from the pockets of the hard people who are working hard. And it comes through taxes. And to determine how much to tax people, you had to get the subjects together and they had to tell you what they owned. And you had to coerce out of them to own stuff they didn't own so you could get more taxes from them. This was the peace. This was the way that they conquered. This is the way that they continued it. Scholars estimate that the Jews were taxed around a total of about 70% from all the taxes they took in, about 70%. Now, the process of determining how much you made or owned was not a fun process. Remember, this is the ferocious Roman Empire, and they wanted money at all costs. I want to read to you, this is a rather lengthy quote from Lactantius. He said, "The census takers appeared everywhere and produced a tumult wherever they went. The fields were measured clod by clod, every grapevine and fruit tree counted, every head of livestock and every kind was listed. The exact number of people noted, noted in the autonomous cities, the urban and rural populations were herded together until the marketplaces were filled with the collected families. All came with their whole band of children and slaves. Everywhere was heard the screaming of those who were being interrogated with torture and beatings. Sons were forced to testify against their fathers, the truest slaves driven to bear witness against their masters, and wives against their husbands. When all of the means had been exhausted, the victims were tortured until they have evidence against themselves. And when pain was at last conquered, taxable property that did not exist was registered. Neither age nor illness won exemption. The ill and the infirmed were dragged before the examiners. Age was set down by estimate, and the age of tax-free minors was raised, while that of the old, who were likewise exempt, was lowered. The marketplaces rang with lamentations." That was the census. I'm so glad it's not like that today. I went down to the tax office here that does the property tax evaluation. I think it was last year, because they had raised the tax on one of my pieces of property. I don't remember which one it was, but. And I was talking to them about it, and they had put it at a certain level. They have categories, classes, I guess. And they put it at a higher class level than anything in Callaway County exists, it seems like. So he's like, "Yeah, I don't know why they did that. We can lower that to the next one." But if this was Rome, they wouldn't care. They would just keep it at the higher level. The other thing that was really interesting to me was that he was telling me the story about this lady who was complaining about her taxes. And he was telling, this is what the tax guy was telling me. He was thinking this to himself. And I don't know why he was expressing this to me. He's like, I can tax you on everything you have, your tree, your bushes, everything that's out there. I can put a tax on. I don't do it. But if you can, I was thinking, if you continue this way, I'm going to do that. And I thought, wow, they can tax you for every flower, every bush, every tree, every shrub, every fence. They can tax you for all the concrete, everything. No wonder the Jews were cutting down trees in Israel, so they wouldn't be taxed on that. It's staggering to think. Brethren, this is the Roman world. Welcome to the Roman world. Welcome to Bethlehem. And in all of this came forth in the fullness of time, a child was born, the true Son of God, who came from heaven. Luke chapter 2, verses 8 through 11. And in the same region, there were shepherds out in the field keeping watch over their flock by night, which tells you this was not in the dead of winter. And an angel of the Lord appeared to them, and the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were filled with great fear. And the angel said, "Fear not, for behold, I bring you good news." This is the true euangelion, the true good news. Good news of great joy that will be for all people, not just for some, not just for the rich, not just for the elite, not just for the ruling class of the Roman Empire. This will be for all people. "For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, who is Christ the Lord." This is a new euangelion, not the good news of Augustus. This is the good news of Jesus Christ, not of fear and trembling, but of joy. So I come to an end here. I want you to consider this important point that we can see from this story. And there are many points that I think you can take out of it. This is the one I want you to get right now. Over the course of human history and all this time that led up to this, God is never early. He is never late. He is always right on time. When the fullness of time had come. This is not a perfect world we live in, folks. You all know that. And it moves further away from God on a daily basis. This isn't the same world you were born into 50, 60, 70, or 80 years ago. It's a completely different world. It's moving so fast. It's amazing. The temptations in some way are worse. The complications are more complex. We are more prosperous than any time in history. There was an article recently that said that we've had the best decade in the history of mankind, I think, in asset growth. And you're living in it. It's amazing. You're living in it. And you can talk about the providence of God, but you're here for a reason. And the fullness of time happens in your life too, as it happened to Jesus Christ. And while in this time in history, it can bring about more comfort in our lives, it can also erode faith in God and advance faith in ourselves. Brethren, we live in the most technologically advanced time in history. There is no other time. This is the most technologically advanced. It's the most glorious time for that. And yet, it is possibly one of the most challenging times to live in. In some ways, technology has not made our lives any better than it was 50, 60, 70, 80 years ago. Because of technology, in some ways, we suffer more. In some ways, we do suffer less. We are more busy in some ways because of the world we live in, and maybe in some ways we're a little bit less busy. We can have more faith in God because of what we see around us, and yet we can have less faith in God because of what we see around us. Kind of depends on how we take it. We can be drawn closer to God, or we can be pulled further away from Him because of so many technological distractions. And one of the biggest ones is this little gadget, this phone in our hands. It is a big distraction in our lives. And maybe this is why America is more polarized than ever before, because of all these distractions. Sometimes you feel that God is not where you want him to be in your life because of your circumstances. Well, I want you to know that God is there. I want you to know he's there. And that he's there when you're busy and you've got things you need to do and things you've got to take care of in your life. And he's there when you're not. And when you have that downtime, he's there with you as well. He's there when you are distracted by all those things that distract us in life. He's still there. And he's there when you're not distracted. And when you have that time, he's still there. He's there, brethren, when you're suffering. And he's there when you're not suffering. He's there all the time. You see, brethren, if God's hand was involved in the thousands of years of history to bring his only son into this world at the right time in order to bring about the forgiveness of sins through the death of his son, then what involvement does he have in your life and mine? The very reason that he was brought into this world was for you and for me. The reason that he was brought here to die, this death, was for you and for me. Why would he be concerned about his son and not you? He's concerned about all of you and every aspect of your life. If his purpose is to regenerate us through Jesus Christ, then his hand is on us as well, guiding us through all things, all circumstances, all difficulties, all challenges, all worries, all environments, and all situations. So as we participate in this thing called life, I want you to remember that you're not here by accident. You're not here by chance, and that God has a plan for your life. And in that plan, God is never early. He is never late. He is always right on time.